The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's author events office, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Philip Lopate. Philip Lopate's essay collections, which the New York Times call observant, elegiac, and far-reaching, include Bachelorhood, Against Joie de Vivre, and Portrait Inside My Head. He is also the author of To Show and to Tell, The Craft of Literary Nonfiction. His other acclaimed work includes a diverse array of travel writing, film and architectural criticism, poetry, fiction, and a memoir which has appeared in periodicals such as the Paris Review and Esquire. A professor of nonfiction writing at Columbia University's MFA program, Lopate is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, two National Endowment for the Arts grants, and is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is here tonight with his new book, The Golden Age of the American Essay, 1945 to 1970, an anthology of some of the most brilliant writing produced in the inspiring and inspired but tumultuous decades following World War II. It includes 38 works by some of our most renowned writers, including critics, sociologists, theologians, historians, activists, theorists, humorists, poets, and novelists. I'd be here all night listing the authors, so I'll just say that it's an awe-inspiring list. Tonight, Philip will be in conversation with Carrie Rickey, former film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, frequent contributor to such periodicals as the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Village Voice, and perhaps most pertinently to tonight's talk, a frequently anthologized essayist in her own right. She's also a longtime friend of the Free Library and the Author Events Office. So we're in for a great conversation, and let's get right to it. Philip, Carrie, thank you both so much for being here, and I'll let you take it away.
Thank you so much, Jason. And hey, Phil. Good evening to the 60 odd people who are there. You're not odd, but the 60 or so people who are out there.
Yes.
And some might be odd, some might be even. Philip and I were trying to reach out and touch each other, but there must be a good Zoom joke here, but I don't know it. So, remember, I don't want to be the only one to ask Philip questions this evening. If you have an idea of what you want to ask him, use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen and leave your question, and I'll try to ask Philip your question later. There should be some full disclosure this evening. While I've been reading Philip Lopate's writing since I was an undergraduate in college, we have been friends for some 38 years. Believe it or not, we met during the disco era at Manhattan's second most notorious nightclub. It was called Xenon, which I believe is the Greek word for stranger, as in xenophobia. And we were introduced by a mutual friend. Understand that the club's walls were silver, like a mylar silver, all the better to reflect the flashing strobe lights that descended from the ceiling. The room aesthetically was like a head-on collision between Andy Warhol opaqueness and Steven Spielberg spectacle. The centerpiece was a spaceship that kind of also descended from the ceiling. And it was designed by Douglas Trumbull, who you know is the production designer of Close Encounters of the Third Kind and 2001. And he was a set designer of Blade Runner. Meeting Philip under these circumstances was for me as incongruous as encountering Julia Child behind the grill at a Tijuana taqueria. But since then, we have been been friends, and I thank our mutual friend Tom for introducing us. Philip is certainly the most prolific person of my acquaintance, writer of poetry, of fiction, of history, of memoir, and editor of more anthologies than I have fingers and toes. He's also, as Jason said, a professor in the nonfiction MFA program at Columbia, which was his alma mater. He once said to me that there are writers who want to seduce, and there are writers who want to be friends, and that he was one of the latter. And when he published his first anthology of essays about 20 years ago, The Art of the Personal Essay, he introduced readers to his literary friends, who happened to include Plutarch, James Baldwin, and Joan Didion. The latter two are in his new collection as well. I think he liked the conversational intimacy that essayists established with their readers. And if you disagree, Philip, you'll tell me.
No, I agree.
Which brings us to Philip's new anthology, The Golden Age of the American Essay. And welcome, Philip, who has beamed to us from his home in Brooklyn's. I thought you were in Cobble Hill. You're not?
Well, Cobble Hill and Carroll Gardens merge in a way. So there's some debate about where one begins.
Got it. Because I thought I was going to Cobble Hill all these years. Okay. So Phil, first, share some autobiographical information. How does a writer, primarily known as a poet and novelist, become an advocate, historian, and one of the more notable contemporary practitioners of the essay?
Well, I think that I fell in love with the essay when I began reading it one summer. I was reading Hazlitt, and he directed me to his friend Charles Lamb, and they both directed me to Michel de Montaigne, and I was off and running. And what I found was that, in a way, the essay could combine the storytelling aspects of fiction with the associational aspects of poetry. So it was right up my alley, and I started writing some personal essays, and my writer friends, who were basically fiction writers and poets, encouraged me to keep doing that. I think they wanted me to get off their own territory. It seemed that I was able to develop a voice that was flexible, that was natural, and that I could trust. Of course, you know, when you're writing in first person, it's never exactly who you are. You're always kind of constructing a persona or a self. But somehow I was able to do that over the course of, 30 years, sometimes being more charming, sometimes being more obnoxious, sometimes being more friendly, sometimes being more curmudgeonly. But in any case, there was a kind of solid sense of who I was coming through all that time, and I sought out other writers like the ones you mentioned, Baldwin and Didion, who seemed to have a kind of consistent personality or voice.
Why do you think the essay is such a flexible, as you said, and congenial form that can accommodate theologians like Reinhold Niebuhr and novelists such as James Baldwin, ecologists Rachel Carson, all of these are in your new book, culture critics like Susan Sontag, foodies like A.J. Liebling, and political observers like Richard Hofstadter?
Well, I think you mentioned my anthology, The Art of the Personal Essay, and I started as a kind of champion of that form. And indeed, the personal essay has been a kind of dominant form of the essay in recent years. But I also found myself gravitating to other forms of the essay. I was doing a lot of criticism, for instance, as were you. It seemed to me that criticism was a disguised form of personal essay because it was always conveying a temperament, an attitude. And so in the anthologies that I've been doing recently, like the Glorious American Essay, which is this one, and the Golden Age of the American Essay, I'm trying to create a kind of big tent notion of the essay, you know, that could encompass all kinds of forms. I think in part, one of the reasons that it is flexible is that it's never had the kind of theoretical pinning down by academics and scholars that poetry and fiction has. It's always kind of evaded that kind of scrutiny. And in a way, the essay has never been as welcomed in the academy as poetry and fiction. You don't find as many courses on the essay in undergraduate literature courses, for instance. So in a way, that gives the essayist a lot of freedom. And one of the things I was trying to do was to say, you know, the essay can crop up in almost any discipline. So for instance, you know, Clement Greenberg in art criticism, Roger Warshaw in film criticism. You mentioned theology, conservation writing. Sometimes an essay can take the form of a letter. Sometimes it could take the form of a sermon. Sometimes it could take the form of a rant. I have an interesting rant in this book by Seymour Krim called Making It, which is a very kind of bittersweet commentary on American success and failure. So I think that it can that the essayist has a lot of freedom, and in fact, you know, the very word essay means an attempt to essay, to try. And so the essay has always been associated with an experiment, you know, which gives the writer a lot of freedom.
In your introduction to this anthology about essays written in the period between World War, between the end of World War II and 1970, you say that one would have to go back to the mid-19th century American Renaissance of Emerson, Thoreau, and Margaret Fuller to see a comparable flowering of the essay form. Tell us what the reasons are for this. I mean, what were the post-World War II essayists members of a movement akin to the 19th century transcendentalists? Were they members of kindred movements like, you know, the Partisan Review crowd represented in your book by James Baldwin, Susan Sontag, and Clement Greenberg, and the New Journalism cohort that included Thomas Wolfe and Joe Didion? What were the differences between then and now? Or then in 1945?
Well, first of all, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do you agree that this was a kind of a good period for the essay?
I didn't realize it. I mean, I read roughly a third of the work and knew it, but I'd never really considered Rachel Carson an essayist, but of course she was. And I'd never thought of Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail as an essay, but it certainly is. And I just, you know, for me in high school and college, essay was Thoreau and Emerson. You know, I didn't had a closed mind.
No, this is why I was trying to expand the notion of the essay. And I do think that the essay is a curious form in that it goes through periods of being very relevant, and then it sort of goes through periods of being sort of like commercial box office poison, you might say. So I think that in this particular period, the post-war period, there were lots of reasons why it came to the fore. If you think about the end of World War II, the United States had defeated the Axis powers. They had defeated the Nazis, and They were suddenly the strongest world power, and I think the writers and intellectuals felt a certain obligation to figure out what America's role should be now, given the sudden tremendous importance of the United States. And it just so happened that at this time there were lots of magazines that came to the fore, that, you know, like Partisan Review, Paris Review, The New Leader, Saturday Review, as well as the more commercial publications, like Playboy or Penthouse or Esquire, which all carried very, very good essays. So
like the one you begin the book with, which is by James Agee from Time Magazine.
Exactly. And Agee was one of those writers who Henry Luce leaned on for certain solemn occasions, like the death of FDR, for instance. And so he asked Agee to do a snapshot of what America was like at this moment in 1945. It was a period when there were lots of magazines, and there were lots of issues that were floating around that seemed eager to be addressed. Like, for instance, racism. The black GIs who were returning, were faced with an America that still was segregated. Sexism, anti-Semitism, environmental problems. So there was no lack of problematic material, and though it was to some degree a happy time because we were victorious, there were also these two enormous shadows over the country, one of which was the Holocaust, the awareness of the concentration camps. Which was becoming more and more present, and the other was the atomic bomb, which had basically ended World War II, and so these two kind of very shocking and dark events, you might say, also played with the consciousness of the writers and intellectuals.
Yes, I wish there were some of those so-called little magazines still around.
Yes.
For the
you must
publishing
feel
of essay.
Exactly. I mean, I think that, certainly, there were many more opportunities for writers to have their say in an essay. And it wasn't this kind of, how shall I put it, coy sense of the essay as a genre. It was simply, sometimes it was seen as an article, sometimes it was seen as a back of the book page, but essentially it was welcomed, and then you had certain essays like James Baldwin's A Fire Next Time, or Norman Mailer's The White Negro, or The Prisons of Sex, which just seemed they seemed hot. They seemed relevant. Nobody thought of them as essays. They thought, I got to read this.
What surprised me while reading the collection, and in many cases rereading, was the extent to how these works written, between 50 and 75 years ago had such contemporary resonance. I mean, it was a jolt to reread Richard Hofstadter's The Paranoid Style in American Politics after having lived through the Trump years. I mean, it was a real jolt. Likewise, Philip Roth's writing about Jews at a time when everyone is talking about his biography.
Yes.
Rachel Carson's, this obligation to endure, her incredibly quiet and reasonable warning about the dangers of insecticides like DDT. And it reading it this time, it struck me with the force of prophecy. if I had to describe the collection, it would be it's both a mosaic of, you know, post-war America, but also a proof that many of those concerns, for example, John Updike's portrait of the relationship between Boston and Ted Williams, transcend that particular place and time. What was your criterion in making these selections? I'm sure there wasn't a single criterion, but.
Well, no, there were several criteria. One was that I had to love the essay. So I think Rachel Carson is a beautiful sentence writer, you know? And in fact, the Library of America put out a collection of her work because she's now starting to be accepted into the canon of American literature, American nonfiction literature. So I had to really connect with it personally. I couldn't put in something that other people liked, but I didn't. And then there was this question of relevance. An essay like Richard Hofstadter's A Paranoid Style in American Politics is unfortunately all too relevant, especially it was during the Trump years, you know, when by the way, it was cited again and again, you know. But then even looking at George F. Kennan's essay on the Soviets' conduct, you know, he was basically saying, this Russia is really not, does not necessarily have our best interests at heart. And even after the fall of communism.
And Joe Biden said that just today.
Exactly. That's why Joe Biden said that today. Exactly. So, of course, some of that relevance was really important. You know, I did want a kind of variety. I wanted a kind of balance, you know. I was given by the publisher 700 pages, which was generous on their part for paperback. But what that meant was that, you know, I couldn't go beyond that. And of course, I could have easily filled several volumes just with great essays from this period. But so I wanted representative essays, and I wanted to show some of the range that was going on at this time. For instance, in the arts, you know, you had Edwin Denby talking about dance, and this was a period with a real breakthrough with people like Merce Cunningham and Ivan Reyna and Balanchine. And then the abstract expressionists talking about Clement Greenberg and the flatness as a kind of a element that seemed to be important. You know, for me, it's interesting because sometimes...
I think it was a rail of importance. I think for Clement Greenberg, flatness was a grail to which artists should aspire.
He later claimed that he was not advocating flatness, but he was simply saying that this was something that was happening. Okay. In any case, you know, the 50s is sometimes seen as a kind of dull period, the Eisenhower years, conformity, and so on. It happened to be a very strong period in the arts, you know, with jazz, with painting, with music, with dance, and so on. So, you know, I wanted to capture some of that excitement.
What I really enjoyed while both alternately scanning and reading was that many of the essays seemed to be talking to each other or around each other, like Vladimir Nabokov's kind of, how can I say it, playful defense of Lolita with its deathless line, nothing is more exhilarating than Philistine vulgarity. And then Lionel Trilling's really sober unpacking of Lolita as, you know, a prolonged assault on one of our unquestioned and unquestionable sexual prohibitions. And I think Trilling found that Nabokov was satirizing, you know, America's hypocrisy about sex. And I think that's where he concludes it. And I really love this imagined conversation between Flannery O'Connor talking about the Southern Gothic, and then Elizabeth Hardwick talking about how vanilla and uninteresting Boston was, and like as if it had been colonized by Harvard. Was this intentional, or can you give us other examples of essays talking to each other?
Completely intentional, because I regard the essay in general as a rather conversational form. There's a conversation between the writer and the reader, which especially in the more colloquial personal essays, you get that sense of intimacy. It's not a speech maker. It's somebody whispering in your ear, you might say, maybe even at 3 a.m, talking to you and only you. And then there's a conversation that takes place between different parts of the writer's brain, because almost all good essays have an element of ambivalence, of contradiction, of a writer thinking against himself or herself, dealing with objections, dealing with qualifications, dealing with doubts, dealing with self-doubts. And then you get the conversation between different writers, which was especially vocal at this moment, partly, I think, because the New York intellectuals all knew each other socially and had no problem taking pot shots at each other and insulting each other in print. So you have Harold Rosenberg saying rather critical things about Lionel Trilling and Robert Warshaw, and Irving Howe saying critical things about Lionel Trilling also. You have to understand, Lionel Trilling was extremely respected at this moment. He was like the untouchable, you might say, which was all the more reason for them to go after him. One of the things I had actually studied with Lionel Trilling, and I became very fond of his writing. And one of the things I like about that essay about Lolita is the patience and the thoughtfulness which he unpacks all of these potential problems in Lolita, which is so different from the way Nabokov was talking about his own book, So I do think there was a lot of cross conversation going on. The New York intellectuals like to think of themselves as basically having a monopoly on intellectual discourse at this moment.
Well, even though some of them, like Joan Didion, was a Californian.
Yes, and in fact, there were a whole group of Western writers, especially women writers, like Susan Sontag, Mary McCarthy, Joan Didion, and Pauline Kael, all of whom relocated to New York City with a certain amount of resentment at what they considered the provinciality of the New York intellectuals, So they came to New York to take their seat at the table while feeling, that there was this kind of regional provinciality of the New York establishment. And I would add Carrie Rickey to that number also.
You're so sweet. I'm not in that league, although Susan and I went to the same high school.
So did you experience that same kind of sense that you had to come east, but at the same time, you felt that New Yorkers were very, sheltered or one-sided?
I think I read a book in the early 70s that basically, I think it was Kinflix by Lisa Alter, that had this line in it: in America, beauty migrates west and brains east. Oh. And that made a lot of sense to me. Yes, and I found New York incredibly provincial. because I met so many people who would never leave, you know, wouldn't even go across the river. That was anathema, you know. And I think I once heard at a dinner party, should we tell our daughter that she was born in New Jersey? And I thought, oh my God. And I once heard in California, you know, is it okay to tell our son he was born in Los Angeles? Is it okay to tell our son he was born in the valley, or will that mark him? Yeah, it was the same kind of idea that these insular worlds. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that happened, if I can interrupt, in the mid '60s, was that the new journalists especially started taking an axe to some of this discourse of the New York intellectuals. And you know, writers like Hunter Thompson and Seymour Krim, and to some degree Gay Talese and Norman Mailer, they wanted a different kind of American language, you might say, and they didn't like this kind of slightly formal high intellectual tone. So that's one of the reasons that I put in. Tom Wolfe, for instance, with his piece "The Girl of the Year," which is a really kind of wacky piece, but it's
really different. Baby Jane Holzer.
Baby Jane Holzer, yes, you know, because you always know, for instance, what Irving Howe is thinking about anything, but Tom Wolfe, it isn't quite clear whether he's making fun of Baby Jane Holzer or defending her, you know. What did you think of that piece?
Well, I had read it before, and I think they're going to a Rolling Stones concert, and she, in her eyes, the Rolling Stones are great because they're all working class, which is not exactly true, as opposed to the Beatles, who were really all working class except for John. But, and I thought, wow, was she off? But I never, you know.
He was working class.
It was a very lively sketch, and I'm sure I'd read it many times before.
And why you? You call it a sketch. Okay. You call it a sketch, and I think that one of the options for the essay was reporting, you know, which is usually not thought of as a province for the essay, you know. But it seems to me that some journalists were really functioning as essayists as well as reporters.
Let's talk about forms of the essay. There's so many different types of essays in the collection. You know, list pieces like Susan Sontag's Notes on Camp, which is also trying to sketch or limn a sensibility, you know. Personal essays like Mary McCarthy's Encounter with an Anti-Semite, James Baldwin collecting his thoughts while living in a Swiss village where he was the only Black man that had ever been encountered in this, you know, hamlet of like 5,000 or 3,000 people. There's Martin Luther King citing theological precedents of resistance. Of resistance to unjust laws in his letter from the Birmingham jail. I know that by temperament, you prefer to defy rather than follow rules, but I have to ask, are there certain rules of essay writing? For instance, it seems to me that political propaganda can't work for an essay because it's too thought out, and essays are more provisional about thinking out loud. I mean, your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I have conflicted thoughts about it. Being to some degree a child of the '60s, I do subscribe to the idea that even when you don't announce your politics, every piece of writing has a kind of politics. Implicit, if not expressed. On the other hand, the essay is let's say a more genial form than than a dogmatic piece, which is kind of like drilling you in the head, you know. And R.P. Blackmore said that the essay was an unindoctrinated form. So it shies away from dogma. It shies away from indoctrination. It shies away from self-righteousness, you might say. It's always willing to see its own complicity instead of just being self-righteous, you know. And because it has that exploratory, experimental aspect, you know, it's like the essayist often starts out thinking about something, not really sure where the thoughts are going to go. And if he or she is lucky, it turns out to be a shapely meditation, you know. So it can't start out with your knowing everything. If you know everything before you start to write an essay, don't bother. There should be some questions that you haven't figured out yet. And in fact, as you're writing, when you do hit on something that you hadn't expected to hit on, the prose becomes excited, becomes rhythmic, becomes sparkling. So in that regard, it's really a good idea not to have all the answers to begin with, you know, but to feel your way into it. And that's part of what I'm calling the genial aspect of the essay.
In the internet age, many of the so-called little magazines that proliferated in the so-called golden age of the essay no longer exist, or let's say they're fewer and fewer. Where do we look for essays today?
Well, I do think that there are many online magazines that publish an essay, and then there's nothing per se about the internet that obviates against a well-shaped essay. And the same thing with blogs. You know, you can write a blog which is shapeless, which is a verbal diarrhea, or you can write a blog which is a beautiful essay. You know, so it's a medium, but it doesn't determine or prevent good essays being written. And there are a lot of online publications now, and then you know they continue to be good essays turning up in the New York Times, let's say, or Wall Street Journal, or Washington Post, and Philadelphia Inquirer. So it happens. You know, the essay is always going to be a minority form, but it's never going to die out. You know.
And my last question is, you mentioned in your introduction that you're looking forward to doing a collection of essays from the 21st century. Who are the essayists you're considering?
Well, it's a long list, as long as the list as in the golden age of the American essay. It will be called the contemporary American essay. And it will have essays that were written only in the 21st century. And it will have, younger essayists like Samantha Irby and Megan Down, let's say, Leslie Jameson, and also older essayists like Joyce Carol Oates and Barry Lopez, because many generations exist at this time. And I didn't want it all just to be middle generation essayists. So I hope you'll check it out when it comes out.
I doubtless will. Okay, I'm going to get some of your questions to Philip. Let's see. Brian Rudnick asks, could you talk a little bit about the lesser known essayists in this anthology?
Well, sure. I mean, some of the lesser known essayists were famous in their day, and are starting to disappear from the mainstream. And I would include someone like Robert K. Merton, who was this great sociologist who invented the notion of the self-fulfilling prophecy to show where prejudice was coming from. And then Paul Goodman, of course, was an incredibly important person in the 60s and 70s. His book, Growing Up Absurd, was on everybody's night table. But nowadays, if you say, who is Paul Goodman, to a young person, they may not know. So he's somebody who is lesser known. I had mentioned Edwin Denby, who was a great dance critic. And this essay, Dances, Buildings, and People in the Street, is really one of the most felicitous essays in the book. I'm not sure how well known someone like Seymour Krim is. And I would say in my first collection, The Glorious American Essay, I had many more unknown essayists who seem to be disappearing, like John J. Chapman, Fanny Fern and people like that. Between the two books, I think there are a number of people who are lesser known. There's an American, a Native American writer named N. Scott Momaday, who is not exactly.
That's a fantastic essay.
Yeah.
I'd never seen it before.
He's a beautiful man.
Paige Lucas asked, is the essay changing? And if yes, who or what is changing it?
Well, I guess it's always changing to some degree. I do think that the essay perhaps has become more confessional, and you may encounter raw admissions that a 19th century essayist would never have thought to make. And some of that has to do with the whole general culture of Oprah Winfrey and Geraldo Rivera and so on, and the greater acceptance of squeamish making confessions, you might say. I also think that the essay has become much more influenced by other media, and in fact is turning up in other media. So now you have essay films, for instance, and you have graphic essays. And so I think the future of the essay may not just be in print, but may be in these other forms as well. So that's another way that it's changing. The essay used to be more amenable to high culture, and now it's much more used to reference popular culture.
And again, I miss that.
It's much more used to reference popular culture, you know? The references now, you know, if you read a contemporary essay, it's much more likely to cite a TV program or a rock song than it is another writer.
Reggie Durstenberg asks, can you parse the difference between belles lettres and the essay? And is belles lettrism a category that you think has disappeared? And if so, why? Interesting question.
That is such an interesting question. Belles lettres usually refers to a certain kind of essay that is written just to give pleasure to the writer and to the reader. And it really comes out of to a large degree, it comes out of the English essay of Hazlitt and Lamb, Robert Louis Stevenson, and so on. I'm a fan of belles lettres. I love beautifully written essays where the style is really the most important part of it. But to some degree, what was seen as belles lettres was also seen negatively as too genteel, the genteel essay, let's say. So the question is Virginia Woolf a belles lettres essay, or is she something different, you know? It would maybe depend on what she's writing. When she's writing for the common reader and she's just writing criticism, maybe that's belles lettres. But when she's writing a room of one's own, I don't think it is belles lettres. So let's say that that the belles lettristic tradition continues to exist. There's a writer named Guy Davenport, who I featured in my first The Glorious American Essay, who I think is a belles lettristic writer. And I still think there are occasionally, I have perpetrated belletristic essays. So I think it continues, but there is this question, this kind of shadow of is it genteel or is it relevant? Is it edgy enough, you might say?
You have a fan in Larry Steinberg who says he's published several books, and each time he rereads your fabulous essay, waiting for the book to come out, which is simultaneously helpful and depressing, but always true. Has this experience changed as publishing has transitioned into the digital age? He asks.
I know Larry Steinberg. Thanks for listening. Yeah, publishing has changed a lot, of course. And one way it's changed, I think, is that the publisher expects the writer to do more self-promotion on social media, for instance. I know I met with various publicists and informed them that sadly I had no Twitter account, I was not on Facebook, I was not on TikTok, I was not on Instagram. They just had to do what they could on their own. So that's one change. And I do think that with fewer publishers and larger monopolistic empires, they're more looking for can they predict that this book is going to make money? It used to be that publishers would take more chances on books that they didn't think would make money, but maybe the second or third book by the author would make money. And now perhaps they're more risk averse, you might say.
I hear publishers talking more like Hollywood producers these days, but yes, risk averse is exactly right. Helen McGrain asks, which essayist publishing today do you think is the best? And again, any young writers you're particularly impressed by?
I can't name one essayist who I think is the best because they all bring different things to the table. But I see a lot of younger essayists that are doing beautiful work, including some of my students. Not to name names, but it's a bit of a shock because I think when I began, I didn't know kids who wanted to become essayists. You know, I mean, you know, if somebody was a teenager who fell in love with writing, usually they wanted to be a poet or a fiction writer. But now we're starting to see more and more young people who are drawn to the essay. You know, I like to think that the Common App essay, which you have to write in high school to get into college, is giving employment opportunities to some of these younger essayists as tutors, you might say. But in any case,
they dropped the essay from the SAT, Philip.
I hate that. I couldn't believe it.
Do you have any closing thoughts about, we just got another question.
I wanted to say something about, because I was thinking about, they asked me about a good essayist. There's this essayist named Brian Blanchfield who's very good. A lot of the essays we're writing today are doing it to defend or define a minority group that they're connected with. So the essay has been a very hospitable form for those on the margins of American society. So you know, be it an ethnic group, sexual orientation, feminist spectrums, various other groups. They're trying to figure out how they belong to a tribe or don't belong to a tribe, and what are the elements of this tribe. And so I think you could call it identity politics, but it's quite useful in a sense, you know. Each group is trying to figure out what it means to be part of that group.
Very well said. I thank you so much, Philip, for sharing your wisdom and acumen with us. And thank you all for coming. I wish we were in the library. And as we say in the Seder, next year in Jerusalem, next year in the Free Library.
Okay.
All of us.
Got an invitation?
Thank you. Yeah. Well, you're welcome in Philadelphia anytime. You know that. And thank you all for coming. And Phil, call me.
Okay. You know, it's very strange. It is a strange experience to be interrogated by one of one's best friends, you know. But it was relatively
painless.
Yes.
No scalpels.
No scalpels.
No knives, no scalpels.
Thank you.
Hope to see you again in more personable circumstances.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.